This ministry is supported by the members and friends of First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. If you would like to support future podcasts, go to www.ucdsm.org to make your contribution.
She was 32 years old. She'd fought the good fight, but the cancer had metastasized. She'd been told she had at most 6 months to live. So she came to the church, never having been part of one before. She came seeking solace and support. She stayed because she realized the church could help her live the life she wanted to live, regardless of how many weeks or months or even years she might have left. Her physicians recommended a bone transplant, bone marrow transplant. We assembled a small chamber choir and went to the hospital to sing outside her door when she was in isolation. The transplant didn't take. Her family gathered around her singly and then together, and they had the hard, deep, transforming conversations, the conversations which in the end make it possible to say goodbye. When the pain became too much to bear, she simply stopped eating. A few days later, surrounded by her resolute and loving family, Elizabeth let go, and she died. It was a remarkable moment. It was sad, of course. She was young. Her death was unfair. But beyond the grief, beyond the immediate sense of loss, was a stunning sense of gratitude. What a gift Elizabeth had given us. She had allowed us into the embrace of her courage. In facing her death with unstinting clarity, she helped all those who gathered at her bedside to likewise face not just our deaths, but how we hoped to live our lives as well. I'm telling you this not only to acknowledge my abiding gratitude for sometimes being among those invited to the bedsides of the dying, but because Elizabeth's behavior says something extremely important about the purposes of the church. Not every deathbed scene reflects the clarity or courage or even kindness I've described. People tend to die the way they've lived. Angry people die angry. Grumpy people die grumpy. Those who live in denial tend to die in denial. Deathbed conversions are extremely rare, despite Victorian lore. When Elizabeth joined the church, she already knew she was very ill and that she would probably die soon. She joined the church because she was confident the people of the church would have the courage and compassion to stay beside her, not to run away. She called us to be our best selves. It was a demand bid from the beginning, and we knew it. When one joins a covenantal church, one enters into a particular kind of relationship with the other members of the congregation. So some of this is very basic, and you've probably already heard it in this series, but too bad, I wasn't here. In some traditions, adherents are asked to subscribe to a creed. A creed is a statement of belief. We approach faith differently here. Rather than asking that you be bound to a set of specific beliefs, we invite you, in Emerson's words, to dare to love God without mediator or veil. We invite you into a way of being religious that centers on the covenantal questions. What shall we promise each other, and in what interest? In Bell Rope, Iowa poet Robert Morgan points to the power of what we share here. The line through the hold in the dank vestibule ceiling ended in a powerful knot, worn slick, swinging in the breeze from those passing. Half an hour before service, Uncle Alan pulled the call to worship, hauling down the rope like the starting cord of a motor. And the tower answered and answered, fading as the clapper lolled aside. I watched him before Sunday school heave on the line as on a well rope. And the wheel creaked up there as heavy buckets emptied out their startle and spread a cold splash to farthest coves and hollows, then sucked the rope back up into the loft, leaving just the knot within reach, trembling with its high connections. 'Each Sunday when the call to worship rings out from this place, we should tremble with its high connections. It calls us to renew ourselves in common worship. It calls us to renew our church by taking up its ministry ourselves. And yes, it calls us to reconstitute the world by the promises we make and keep and break and then renew. So what do we promise one another and in what interest? Our heritage of openness and freedom calls each of us to an original experience of the holy. In Emerson's first published essay, 1836, an essay called Nature, he asks, why should not we have an original relation with the holy? That's what the word unity means. It means that the experience of the holy is not culturally determined, that different cultures and different ways in religion tell different stories about the same experience. It's about the unity of experience. It's an assertion about the reality that we actually do have more in common than that which separates us. And that the primary thing we have in common as human beings is what Tillich called a longing for the reunion of the separated. That's his definition of love. The longing for the reunion of the separated. It is that longing which makes it possible for us to cross every boundary and to learn to love more perfectly. Good timing. Thank you. So in our tradition, ministers provide companionship and sometimes testimony, but we do not serve as intermediaries between you and your God or your experience of the holy. When we say we have no creed, it does not mean we don't believe in anything. It means we believe that the religious life is lived most powerfully by those who are willing to think for themselves. It means that there is no substitute for a direct personal experience of the holy. This is no easy path. This is not religion light. Some see the liberal church as a lukewarm, undemanding alternative to the hardcore obligations of more fundamentalist traditions. That is nonsense. It's true. You can sit back in your pew and be entertained and go your merry way, but if you want the church to work for you, if you want it to work in your life, you're going to need to grapple with the essential theological questions, not so much as to answer them, but in the hope that the wrestling itself will strengthen and clarify your days. The covenant we make with one another is therefore not a statement of shared belief. It's a set of promises, both spoken and implied, about how we need to be together if we wish to grow in faith and authenticity and power. In late spring of the year of our Lord, 1648, when the mud had hardened enough to make travel possible, delegates from all of the Puritan congregations then established in the colonies gathered on the Cambridge Common to consider final approval of a platform of church discipline. The congregations of New England, organized into four districts at that time, Plymouth, Massachusetts Bay, New Haven, and Hartford, whole world, had spent the previous 15 years developing the plan. The plan included four key principles. The autonomy of the local church, we like that one. The representative character of the ministry, we'll get into that. The covenantal relationship of church membership, we're a little bit squeamish about that. And the obligation of fellowship and friendly counsel with other churches on matters of particular or general concern, we're definitely not comfortable with that. With the approval of what has become known as the Cambridge Platform, refreshing your memory out there, Aaron, of 1648, a framework was established which has served us quite well these past few centuries. At best, our Unitarian Universalist congregations embody and exercise all four key principles. The first principle, the autonomy of the local church, is the best-known section of the platform. It played a pivotal role in the development of American democracy. In asserting that the constituent members of a congregation have the innate authority to govern its affairs, the platform foreshadows the inalienable rights that would be set forth more than a century later in the Declaration of Independence. It can be argued, in fact, that the very concept of the right of revolution began in the Protestant Reformation. Your right to ordain, your right to ordain and call is hard won. It is a deeply serious exercise in congregational authority. You and only you have chosen Mark and Aaron as your ministers. Their ministry is representative, however, in a very particular way. They are not your lawyers in God's court. The second principle of the platform is the representative character of the ministry. In our tradition, ministers are not mediators. They do not represent us. They do not forward or interpret our prayers to a God who listens primarily, if not only, to the clergy. Our ministers are representatives in the sense that they reflect and model the ministry we share. These are the words of the prophet Isaiah. The Spirit of God has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to comfort all who mourn, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. They shall build up the ancient devastations, the devastations of many generations. You shall be called ministers of your God. You may know that this congregation was first gathered in the summer of 1877 when the Reverend John R. Effinger, who had spent the previous 4 years planting Unity Church in St. Paul, served as our first minister, came down from Keokuk, having resigned the St. Paul pulpit to become the Unitarian missionary in Iowa. So he came down from Keokuk to help you get started. In the years since your founding, you've exercised your right to call and ordain ministers. You've also learned, I trust, that it doesn't let you off the hook. Yes, Mark and Aaron are your ministers. But inspiring and powerful and graceful as their ministry may be, it only represents the far greater depth and strength and staying power of your ministry. History matters. It matters who we say we are and where we come from. Our liberal forebears found comfort in the first two principles of the platform, but have neglected the third and the fourth. The third essential principle adopted at Cambridge called for covenantal relationships among the congregations. This concept has been degraded in recent times. It has become part of our anti-authoritarian rhetoric. indicating that we subscribe to no creed, thank you very much, and are therefore freer, smarter, certainly more humble, and generally better than other people. Worse yet, and forgive me, worse yet, the word covenant has become modified by the word behavioral, as though the central discipline of the congregational life is the process of avoiding conflict. How are we going to get along? I was once told by a very significant donor of our congregation that she said, "You will agree, I'm sure, that the primary duty of the senior minister of a large congregation is to keep the peace." And I was in a bad mood. And I said to her, no, I think the primary duty of the senior minister of a large congregation is to stay up in the skinny branches and shoot the predators. She wasn't listening, fortunately. The word covenant, though usually used as a noun, is more usefully understood as a verb. The two covenantal questions, what shall we promise each other and in what interest, affirm the need for and the nature of covenant. In affirming that need and that nature, the great Jewish theologian Martin Buber, as you heard earlier, wrote that we are a promise-making, promise-keeping, promise-breaking, promise-renewing people. Covenanting is itself the central discipline of congregational life. Now, I know you've been going through this long, slow process of changing the governance by which you run your church. And sometimes that gets annoying, and some of you who are involved in it or at the edge of it find it almost amusing as you grapple with policy development. I think the children's story did a marvelous job of pointing to our tendency to develop policy rather than have direct conversations. But the truth of the matter is that the governance form that you're embracing as a congregation is a covenantal form. It lends itself powerfully and in particular ways to the process of promise making that is at the heart of our tradition. When we neglect the deep, challenging conversations which form the beating heart of congregational life, we easily fall into idolatry. Idolatry is mistaking the finite for the infinite. When we cease to ask ourselves, what shall we promise and in what interest, we find ourselves worshiping the church itself. Our primary raison d'etre becomes the perpetuation of the institution, instead of living into the mission which the church was first formed to pursue. The fourth and final principle asks that we maintain fellowship and friendly counsel with other churches. What a novel concept. Could it be that we actually have something to learn from other people? Is it possible there are times we could be more effective if we band together, or tasks too complex than those we can address by ourselves? It is true that only you can make a minister. Only you have the right of ordination. It's also true that you could not possibly do it by yourself. Your ministers were called to ministry before they were invited to Des Moines. This may surprise you. Their lives were shaped by family and friends. Their ministries informed by their years in seminary. They were tested and tried by their clinical pastoral work and internships and their previous experiences in ministry. They are, in effect, licensed to preach by the Unitarian Universalist Association, which is itself an expression of our collective commitment to fellowship and friendly counsel. It's only fair that we be clear about what we promise ourselves, each other, and the world when we commit to this way of being religious. Most churches ask their people to support the church, attend regularly, make a financial commitment that fairly reflects the importance of the church in your life, and volunteer to share the workload. Does this sound familiar to you? If you were asked what are the expectations of the Unitarian Church of Des Moines, it would be pretty much that stuff, wouldn't it? Yeah. The default covenant, therefore, is basically, I will support the church for as long as I live. It's no wonder young adults are hesitant to sign on. The promises we ask of each other need to be portable. We need to take them with us when we go. The promises we make transcend the institutions that encourage and enshrine those promises. Those who find the clarity to turn to the life of the Spirit will always be present and grateful to those who help them find it. Stay, I said to my loves, each answered, always. The things most churches ask of their people are important, but they are not the core commitments I want you to consider this morning. Here are the promises I think we should ask you to make for yourselves, for each other, and for the world. Promise yourselves you'll carve out the time to learn and then to practice a daily spiritual discipline. If you're queasy about spiritual, then call it maintenance. A maintenance discipline. It will help you to find and keep your balance and to live a more loving and more effective life. I'm sure of it. For each other, gather in small groups. Learn to listen. Try to tell the truth. The intimacy you earn will help you learn to build creative relationships with all the neighbors you have yet to know. In time, you'll learn to go deep quickly with strangers. In time, the daily practice and the growing intimacy will open your heart to compassion. Organize the compassion that rises. Promise the world to bring that compassion to bear by way of blessing, service, learning, and advocacy. The world cries out for activists grounded in practice, good at making friends, and motivated by compassion. When we live into these three promises, we learn to support the church out of gratitude far more than out of duty. And gratitude is sustainable. The church provides a framework for promise making and promise keeping. And when we break our promises, as we inevitably will, the church provides a framework for forgiveness and a place in which promises can be renewed. We have our work to do. It's very intimate. Elizabeth joined the church because she saw us making every effort to live out the values we proclaim in the detailed compassion of our daily lives. She knew somehow we were strong enough to see her through, loving enough to help her let go. She called us to be our best selves. We rose to the occasion, always have, and always will. May it be so, and amen.